The problem was in 2021, we were going to shut the play club down. Like, we were like, all right, we're done. I was just about to walk away from tabletop role playing.
Welcome to the Red Caps Podcast, a podcast where we dip our caps into the blood of our listeners and we ramble on a bit old school games. In today's episode, we are going to be chatting with Ross from Mythic Mountain RPG. Mythic Mountain RPG is a gaming club. They put up a lot of their actual plays of various OSR games on YouTube. And it's an interview that was set up by somebody on Reddit reaching out to me and saying, hey, I know this really cool person. They love the OSR. I think you guys have a fantastic conversation. And they were 100% right. This was a really, really fun conversation. So let's keep that going. If you know cool people, put me in touch, because they knocked it out of the park. I couldn't ask for a better conversation to have. And I hope you guys all really enjoy it. So without doing a whole lot more preamble, I'm going to let the interview speak for itself and toss it over there. So for now, I hope you guys can all sit back, listen, and enjoy.
How you doing, sir?
I'm doing fantastic.
So we got on the mic here a minute ago, and you're like, I don't even know why I'm on the podcast. And the reason that you're on is I got a message on Reddit. I had put out a call as I was kind of getting the podcast going again. And I put out a call. I was like, hey, does anybody have people that they think should appear on it? Or, do you have an interesting conversation you want to have about gaming? And I got a message on Reddit that said, hello, I love the show. And I'm glad to hear that you're looking for guests. Missed the show. By the way, thank you to that person for the awesome comments. I would recommend Ross from Mythic Mountain Games. He has a podcast. He has a YouTube page. He's got a Discord server. He's a great guy. He's the most knowledgeable person I know about all things OSR.
Oh, no.
So he built you up really good. And I was like, yeah, sure. Sounds like an awesome. I went and checked out the YouTube video, YouTube channel, sorry. So that was, I was like, yeah, please put you in contact. And we managed to make the time work. So tell me what Mythic Mountains is and what kind of like the YouTube page and podcast and stuff is that you're, the media empire, as we like to say, that you're starting to build.
Gosh. Yeah. Well, I'm afraid my friend was gravely mistaken. But hopefully what lack of knowledge I can make up for in enthusiasm. That's kind of like my philosophy as a dungeon master sometimes. So
that's all I've done since I've sat behind a microphone. So
yeah, I since this is an OSR podcast, is that fair to say? But also a bit general D&D as well, but I've enjoyed it for years as a thing to help me get into the OSR. This is one of the things that kind of helped me cross the bridge. So I ran Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, because if you're super into it, you're probably running it. And I ran it for like 6 years. And that was my milieu for 6 years. And I discovered the old school Renaissance. And I say that my hobby is like 10 times more fun for me now. Like, I'm just obsessed with it. I just love it. So the YouTube channel, we just do like really low production, just hit and record and being like, hey, look, if you want to watch, here you go. And yeah. Some people really enjoy that. What I like about it, for one thing, first of all, we're a play club. So just to start out with just what Mythic Mountains is, it's a group of friends started in Kentucky. We used to go around to different cities and we would kind of unfold D&D, all our books and stuff. My wife and I said we're like a traveling D&D salesman. We'd go to a town and be like, here, try D&D. And I'd go up, to a friend's house and do a one shot. And it sort of foreshadowed my love of the OSR, because I really loved first level, eventually the pandemic hit and we moved online and it kind of exploded. And there were people all over the world that were like, hey, I'm stuck at home. I want to play Dungeons and Dragons. And I met like hundreds of people and I was unprepared for that. And Mythic Mountains eventually became the play club that grew out of the experience of, how do you do that? How do you interact with people all over the world? How do you create a place where people can come and play reliably and enjoy themselves and feel comfortable? Yeah. And that's our main thing. And then we just share it on YouTube.
Yeah. And you were saying like, it's a hit record. So it's more of a, I usually categorize actual plays into two main categories. There's some that kind of blurt between the lines, both of them, but I see them as like performance oriented actual plays,
yeah,
and fly in the wall actual plays. And so yours would probably lean more towards the fly on the wall, where, you know, if it was just another player who didn't have a character sheet and they're just sitting and watching the game as it played, that's how it would typically go. At least from the ones I've seen. Do you see any difference between actual plays like that, or do you watch other ones? Because I don't. I watch very few, to be honest. I probably catch, I don't know. The only one I'm following exclusively right now is actually a game I don't even play, Pathfinder 2. I've watched a Pathfinder 2 one, but
that's a good, that's interesting. Yeah. I usually tend to think of it like, what kind of production quality is there? Because an interesting actual play that everybody in the OSR, you know, if they know of one, they know this one, kind of breaks that model, is 3D6 down the line, right? because they're, you know, production quality and their audio quality and everything, the presentation and everything is flawless. Like, it's like, you know, like something you'd pay for, but we get to enjoy it for free. But they are rigorously, look, we're friends playing, and they play the game, and that's what they do. I won't mention others. I have watched some in the past. Part of what I hope to do, and I still find this is the case, it's interesting because, like, we did Classic Traveler. I'm like obsessed with Classic Traveler right now. And so some people come in and I get really nice comments, and they're like, wow, I really enjoyed it. And I'm not doing those for entertainment. What I was going to say is, I think for me, I like them as kind of like an artifact. I use your podcast for that sometimes. Like, I'll take parts of it. I'll be like, hey, listen to what he says about this. Like, if a subject comes up, I can crystallize a concept in the OSR and be like, look at this. This is, they get it here, or this, you know. And I do that. There's YouTube, you have the clip feature now. So you, yep. I can zoom in and I can say, look, NBX, here's what happens when you don't take that rest. And when you haven't in you know, after a certain number of rounds, like, here's, you can see, here's us playing, running B4, and you can see in the dungeoneering what happens with this. So when some concept comes up, I can grab out of the bag, where it's happened to us in the past. And that's cool, because it's harder sometimes to just explain things, because like someone I talked to says that this whole thing has a kind of hermetic quality. So if it doesn't actually happen in play, it can be really hard to explain and experience.
Yeah, I find, like, I often use actual plays to get a sense of how the play goes before I've sat down at a table to play it.
Yeah.
And especially, like, even probably more so than with tabletop RPGs, but with board games. Like, our family is a big board game family. And like, every time we buy a board game, I hardly ever look at the rules first. I immediately just jump onto YouTube and go and look for, hey, show me how to play this game in 5 to 10 yep. minutes, and go through it that way. And then I'll go back and reference the rules if something didn't make sense. But I get such a better understanding of what's happening by watching somebody exactly. play it. There's John from the Red Dice Diaries. I remember him famously always saying that he records his games as well, but he records them. He goes, I don't really care if anybody watches them at all. He goes, I'm recording them so that I don't have to make session notes. he goes, I can go back and just watch the video and know what happened. And I always thought that was a neat idea. It's just I'm recording it for me. And if you happen to enjoy it, great. But yeah, the production value is definitely important. But I do find that there's a difference between those who seem to be playing for their audience, which right. doesn't mean they're not playing the game, but they're actively recognizing the fact that they have an audience and they're playing up for the audience, versus those who are only concerned about playing for those who are also in the game itself. So right. the audience is their fellow players versus anybody who might be watching. And that's kind of how I typically differentiate an actual play is, you know, where is the performance being aimed at? Is it aimed at the listener that's watching the actual play, or is it aimed at your table mates and going through that way? Not saying one's better than the other, just that's how I kind of see the two of them
Well, I think another aspect of that too is, so why even do it, right? Other than the, hey, I'm kind of recording these little things that could be shown later, or it's a record of our play, or whatever. And the other thing is this sense of, and I feel like this is really the case in my experience in the OSR community, is that this is just open. Like, hey, like a, this sort of culture of totally open collaboration and an excitement to share everything. We're not trying to secret this stuff away. And that almost like if you're coming into a game store or a convention or something like that, yeah, hey, come on in. If you want to be a fly on the wall, you're welcome to it. And in about 10 years ago, that was the only way I had a group, but I don't know if you've ever had this phase in your hobby or know people that are like this, where, you know, like the people you play with, you only get to play every 6 months, or maybe, you know, like everybody always cancels. Like a lot of people, that's their hobby. They don't, you know,
D&D quickly turns into how can I schedule something? It's a management problem.
So for, I had that hobby in 2015, right? So, there were podcasts back then, and the kind of proto Genesis era of Critical Role. Critical Role was like this for the first few episodes. They're, you could hear their mouth noises and eating stuff, and it's kind of wild. You could literally hear Matt Mercer like press a play button on some some video game music tracks, you know. And anyways, there were podcasts back then that's just like, hey, you don't have a place to play, you can listen. And that was all I had. And there are people that's still the case, although it's interesting now because I know how to find players and set up games online. And so what I was going to say is, like, we had this Classic Traveler game, and there's this guy, it's just happened last week. He messaged, he's like, man, I want to find a Classic Traveler game so bad. So I'm glad I found this, because I just, you know, I don't have a place to play Classic Traveler. So I just want to watch this. So I was like, well, you want to play with us? You know, like, here you go. And you know, hey, maybe we can't do it right away, but we can work it out, or I can get you in touch with somebody. And so the part of the goal is to, about 10 years ago, I observed that the hobby kind of had this basement phenomenon. Like if you didn't know somebody, if you don't know somebody that can help you into it, you can't get into it. And there's a kind of a problem with that now with the broader, I'll call it modern D&D, the prevailing D&D culture, where, you know, there are certain types of game experiences you can access, but it remains a problem to just find a authentic table of people that are friends that are willing to let you come in and try it out. So part of the goal is to crack that open and allow people to have a real table and meet people and play.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a need to have that introduction. And it's difficult because I think a lot of people get, it's part of the problem that I think social media has built up around the game, in terms of, I'll hear stories, and I'm not to say that these experiences never happen, but there's experiences that get talked about online as if it's an everyday occurrence that I have never in my life experienced. And anybody I talk to, they're like, no, I've never seen that before. It almost feels like there's a fan fiction of really negative experiences around D&D that gets talked about as if it's like a cardinal truth. But, and maybe, again, not to say it's never happened, but it definitely hasn't been something that I've seen in my experience very often. And I think that shies people away from trying sometimes, and also might shy people away from pulling people in because they're not sure if they're going to be get labeled into this fan fiction that they don't see as happening. So I think having you know, actual plays out, or if you're at a gaming store or convention, just having it be real easy for people to walk up and see what's going on and see smiling faces and hear laughter around it is a kind of a key point there. When we were chatting back and forth, you said one of the key things you wanted to talk about on here today, and one of the things that you kind of have as part of the podcast you have going on, was folk versus, let's say, commercial RPG gaming. I think I've got a pretty strong idea of what you're going for with it, but how do you describe folk gaming as opposed to commercial gaming? If we want to delineate it that way.
Yeah, actually. And I'll just say also this, so we were talking about the goal of having a place where people can try it out and play. And there's this environment of open collaboration and, you know, feeling comfortable to be able to come and try it out and know that you can get something good and see if it's for you. And to skip ahead, because the folk RPG idea for me is still a working hypothesis. It was like, so start with the problem and then skip ahead to the result. And then I'll talk about the solution, hypothetically. The problem was in 2021, we were going to shut the play club down. Like, we were like, all right, we're done. I was just about to walk away from tabletop role-playing. Because it was, you were talking about the horror stories. I've had those. Like, I've actually, and I didn't know, after 2020, I didn't know how to, how do you do that? Because the world had changed. And the way that we could play tabletop had changed, and I was meeting all these people. So like, I'm not a internet person. I'm not a social media person. I don't know how to do that stuff. So folk RPG gaming for me was a hypothesis for how to fix problems I was having in 2021, and skipping ahead to 2024, it seems to have worked, and we have more games and more people running games, and we have a consistently good experience where people can reliably show up and feel comfortable and safe and play a game. So that kind of is my sales pitch. Now, is that what caused it? How does it work? I don't know. So this is a working hypothesis. Here's what I think folk RPG gaming is theoretically, and then how I think it works in practice. Theoretically, it's like, it's the simple, hey, your table, your rules. That's like kind of like the simple version of it. But the theory of it is, you know, that you have that idea of bad, wrong, fun. Like, what is bad? Like, what doesn't work? And I found that is often, people do a lot of appeals to authority, and they may do that from a book that they buy, or they may do that from, here we are, presumably talking on the internet. Like, people like here, yep, like talking on the internet, and they get that idea from that. And so what's the opposite of bad, wrong, fun? Like, what is good, right, fun? The folk RPG gaming experience starts with the premise that comes from a group of friends at a table and the actual game experience that comes out of it. Now, that sounds really theoretical, but what I think the difference between folk RPGs and brand RPGs are, and this is not me saying brand RPGs are bad. I've got a D&D hoodie that I wear. Okay. So I do, I buy merchandise too. I buy products. I like companies. This is not saying this stuff's bad, but a folk RPG is the idea that it works like, it's not like something you can go to Walmart or to a store and buy. It's a folk hobby. So a difference is, you can buy fishing products. You can listen to personalities about fishing. When I was a little kid, I liked Roland Martin, and I like watched his TV show. I was like really into fishing. But ultimately, fishing is actually available to everyone, and no one cannot not fish, and everybody can cast a line into the water, and that's fishing. Like, not the ideas, not the personalities, not the spinner bait that you buy. Fishing, you can just get a worm and put it on a hook and throw it in the water, and you're fishing now. And that's the difference. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
That makes complete sense. I think I've often said that, I've had people come up and ask, I've had discussions on like Reddit where somebody will come in to say the OSR subreddit, and their very first question that they ever ask is, hey, can you give me all the best home rules that you have for insert whatever game? Often it's OSE, just because OSE is so popular. Give me your best house rules. And I always kind of reply, like, you know, people are very helpful. So people start throwing out, hey, I use this at my table. I use this at my table. And I often first say, not that there's anything wrong with any of those house rules, but play the game as it is first, and then let your table decide what works for you. Because what works for
me, they should have read page B3, right?
Yeah, like
if isn't that what Moldvay says?
Yeah, like if I'm enjoying something, or if I make a modification, it's because it was a pain point that I saw in the game or something I wanted to modify, but you might not. Right. And if you make that change without having gone through it the way it was, you may be, one, robbing yourself of an experience on it, but two, you might not like what I changed. Right. Yeah. And then you're going to think that the game is based off of what I changed, when really that was for me. So I always thought that the idea that people should grow the game based off the people that they're with. And so make that starts with house rules, that goes through to just their attitude around the games. Like I've always, again, taking it back to social media, because I find that's where a lot of the misconceptions around this happen, because there's such a difference between the conversations you have with social media versus the conversations you have with people when they stand up from a table on a break.
Yeah.
But like you'll hear, we're going through the cycles here on Twitter. It's almost comical to watch how often the same conversations loop around, but you'll have the conversations on the 5e's wheelchair, magical wheelchair, and people are freaking out. It's like, then don't use it at your table. Like
So an interesting thing about like the wheelchair thing is that what's lost is actually that in that format, it is impossible to express what might actually be something that's going on with a group of people that is just not going to cross in Twitter. Like, so I talked to the guy who kind of pioneered ideas like that. He worked on Call of Cthulhu, where and very initially that kind of ideas like that were really important. And the conversation has diverged just in the format. Like, it's impossible to actually have a kind of a real conversation about that. And to flip it on the other side of that, on the Twitter part, initially when I was exposed to ideas like, so I'm really interested in classical play like now. I love it. But when I was exposed to it, in the Twitter expression of it, like one for one timekeeping and a simulated world, I was like, this is gross. This is terrible. What is wrong with because the format does not express that. And this is an example of like the hermetic aspect, where it really is only going to come out in play. And usually the best minds in that kind of stuff will say, listen, ultimately this isn't theoretical. Ultimately, this is something you got to do at a table. And when I actually tried that classical stuff, I like blew my mind. And I was like, this is the best Dungeons and Dragons I've ever played. And the only way that I could have done that was actually connecting with people face to face and playing a game.
Yeah, it's because of the nature of it's not even so much social media, although it definitely is to a certain extent, but it's a, especially in the OSR space, I've felt over the last X number of years that things have become, the OSR side of the hobby has become much more commercialized. So rather than me having a cool set of house rules, like let's say I've got a dozen house rules I want to put on top of BX, instead of me just like sharing them and putting them on a forum, I'm now running the Kickstarter and making a whole new version of BX. And
like, you know, on one hand, that's cool, right? Because
right,
I have like Kickstarters and I have fun, and you know, I'll buy products.
Well, I've got
I think I know what you're saying.
BX over here beside me yeah, in with different covers on them to last a lifetime. But I find that because of that, you often, it feels like the suggestions or the conversation becomes, this is the best way to do this, or this is the way you must do this. Instead of just being like, hey, I tried this, it worked for me. And I think if you can get that tone difference is what separates whether the conversation goes into a, oh no, you didn't, and now I'm upset with you, versus, yeah, oh, okay, well, now we can have a chat. There's on Twitter, there's a lady named Harmony Ginger that.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah, she's actually gonna be on the podcast. We're having
a conversation. Oh, I'm so excited about that. That's great.
But if you go back to the one-on-one time, you know, that got lambasted on Twitter because of the group of people that brought it forward and the way that they brought it forward and their attitude towards it, I feel, more so than the actual concept itself. She took it, she went and experimented, and she came back and she said, hey, I tried this on my table, and this is what happened. And everybody was like, oh, that's really, like, the difference in tone of how somebody approached one to the other. I don't think it had so much to do with the personalities, although one could argue that there is a difference in the personality. I think it was just more about how it was presented of like, hey, I tried this and this worked really well versus thou shall do this or thou is playing D&D wrong. And yeah. One just puts people's backs up and the other one doesn't, right? So I think the folk side of it, if you can approach it in a case of, hey, I just stood up from the game I was playing and guys, we tried this and it was awesome. And you come up with that enthusiasm versus thou shall not ever do it.
Or at the very least, those are two different things. So yeah, like by the way, I want to say like this podcast was a major inspiration for me to start a podcast about folk RPG gaming. So on our podcast, we had Hank Renfernell from Runehammer.
Isn't he awesome?
Yeah, it's great. It's fun and wild to listen to some of his podcasts and his discussions and stuff, because he really kind of is on that line between constantly trying to challenge ideas versus, hey, we got to play a game. And that's something that constantly comes up. So that's what we talked about. And his major challenge, he's looking at something similar as a kind of general problem that the pandemic, the whole thing that happened in 2020 might be more, it may have affected us even more than we think. And it may have really changed a lot. And that the best thing we can do, and I'm observing this when I see people go to conventions, I'm seeing people meeting face to face. And I'm seeing a lot of things that seem like impossible problems just melting with that. And I saw that in my career. Like I was in the Army for 13 years, and I observed how we had this base, right? And when I was deployed, and we were on the edge of the base, and the headquarters was on the far other end of the base. And there's this weird tribal thing that happens among human beings where I can't even express the number of just misunderstandings that happen just from that geographic reality. Like the very fact that we were physically separated, I could actually see things come up. It's natural. This negativity bias is part of our survival instinct that you naturally distrust the thing over on the other end of the base. And so the key in situations like that, like they would pay, and companies do this, right? Like they'll pay thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars to physically connect key leaders and go physically in person. That's how crucial it is. And anyways, I think we're starting to see that, and I'm seeing problems just naturally resolve by people like being in the same physical space. Now, a lot of us can't do that still. And maybe that's in a way that the world has really changed. The solution to that we've seen is what you and I are doing now that probably the audience can't see, is I'm looking you in the face.
Yep.
I really like, there's a guy named Joe the Lawyer. I don't know if you, he has this principle, cause he has to play online cause his friends are online. Right. So, they play second edition, and he has this kind of principle of play that says, we're playing online because these are my friends and I want to hang out with them, but we have an analog mindset. Like, and so when I meet people, I say that, I'm like, hey, this is like, I'm coming over to your house and we're sitting down at the kitchen table. Like, we're going to treat it like that. And that solves a lot of the problems around online play, actually. And you get a better experience. I don't know that it can ever replicate actually being in the same physical space, but it solves a lot of problems.
Yeah, I think I've had great success with playing online. And I think it can be hindered if people don't have enough of a good camera setup or good audio. Like, I think that's when somebody's got the really bad audio or a real bad camera to where you can't let that fade to the background. So whenever you've got the a constant noise coming from their end, or the, any of those sorts of distractions, it snaps you out of that whole, hey, we're just sitting here talking. But like right now, I know you can't see in this direction, but I've got you on up on a big screen TV here in front of me. So like you're covering my entire field of view. You basically would be sitting on the other side of a table from me. Yeah. The way it's going.
And a major experience that humanizes this is I can see your C2 rower. I know he rows.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. It's dramatically underutilized. Unfortunately.
Oh no.
but it is fantastic back then. I love that thing. I just need to be on it more often.
me too.
Yeah. I head off to go play hockey this evening, and I bet you I'll get halfway through the game, go, man, my cardio would be whole much better if I spent some more time on that rower. But, yeah. But what you're kind of describing though, in terms of like the game growing from the table that it's sitting at, and it being tailored to the players that have it, and being able to discuss problems and make changes to it, I think that's always been there. Like I've always said that. Sure. I don't think Gary Gygax played D&D. Gary Gygax played Greyhawk, and Dave Ironson didn't play D&D. He played Blackmoor. And there's a lot of people who they're not playing the game is a framework, but the game that they play is the one that's made at their table.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that concept gets carried over to new, like, I don't think there's people that grasp that right away, partly maybe because they're more familiar with board games where the rules are the rules, and somebody might have house rules like a Monopoly. You land on this piece and you get, you know, free parking or something. For the most part though, people don't house rule board games all that much. And if it's in the rules, and that's, you know, it's you're almost playing the rules strategically trying to win. And so whenever you see people that say, well, no, you have to have all these races in the game, or you have to provide all these feats, and how dare you change this? And it's becomes a combative thing. I think it's just because people haven't grown up into this whole, like, no, that game is just suggestions for what we're going to do. Here's how we actually bring it together and just have fun together rather than trying to win the game. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. It does make sense. And I would say, I feel like I almost have to temper this, this is not the same as me saying rules don't matter or system doesn't matter or ideas don't matter. And I love all of that stuff. And in fact, on the YouTube channel, it's an intentional discomfort that I confront. Like the beginning of our Classic Traveler campaign was a mess. It was a disaster. And it was because I was trying to experiment. I was trying to confront problems and challenges. And I will sometimes... I got a comment recently where they're like, why did the player just make a roll without even asking the game master? Now, this is an interesting thing, because in an OSR game, I would probably have the same reaction. I'd be like, why are you even rolling? You probably are not even going to roll. You're probably not going to roll the whole session. What are you doing? But I intentionally, so I play free league games. I play the apocalypse games. I try to break up keep my neuroplasticity going, try to break up those neural pathways and actually challenge my thinking, try different things. I'll intentionally do something that I think is wrong with the consent of the group. I don't just like, you know, not wrong, but like something that I feel uncomfortable with or don't feel familiar with, to try it out. And like, anyways, I'm not saying that thinking doesn't matter, discussions, rules. And I think a big part of this is just the social part of this. And I feel like that's almost like 90% of it. The classical crowd figured this out. And this is an example of something that didn't transmit on the internet to me. They said, it's a game. Now, what I heard them say was, it's just a game. Well, obviously, it's not just a game. We're sitting here doing a podcast about it. It's kind of a big deal for us, right? Like, we're pretty passionate about it. But the fact that it's a game ends up solving a lot of problems, because like that comes with how do you actually approach things. And I had conversations you would never have about like going to the movie with a group of friends. So I had to reconstruct how does social stuff work in this post 2020 world on Discord, playing a game on the internet. It's almost like I had to go back to back to class, back to kindergarten. Like, how do you even, how do you do this, these basic social things? And that's the stuff that is so group facing. Like, and that's the thing that's, I don't think you can transmit that on Twitter, especially however many characters you have. Like,
yeah,
some groups are going to be low context. They're going to rib each other. They're going to pick on each other. And that's going to look real awful to some people, but that's like people that love each other. And then other groups are going to be high context. And anyways, having this group facing approach, another result that's come out of it has been meeting a lot of people all over the world. And you can end up with people that are very, very different, and they end up finding ways that connect instead of ways they don't connect, you know? So
yeah, people are more alike than they are different. Like,
right.
if you've traveled at all, you'll meet people that maybe had you never traveled there, you would have thought that their life must be dramatically different from yours. But the vast majority on the planet have the same wants and needs as everybody else. They, yep. they want to go to a job, make enough money to help their family, have a good meal, love their kids, move on with their day, find something that they enjoy and you know, interact with it. At the end of the day, every human basically has that same pattern. The specifics might change a little bit, but you know, once you understand that, the differences don't really seem that big, at least in my opinion.
That's been a major thing I've been trying to protest. So I see some of these things come up I'll just call it Twitter. it's like a, this dark evil web or something. I don't mean that. If it weren't for Twitter, like you mentioned Harmony Ginger, and how cool is it there? I'm like, oh yeah, I know about her, you know, like, so that's great. But, I mentioned like my experiences. I've been all over this planet and I've seen all kinds of cultures. I've been all kinds of countries. And I have observed that. I've observed this kind of universal human connection that is accessible to every single person on the planet. Everybody can connect with another person on basic human connections. And what I see is that coming into question. In the Twitter exchange, and I think my major challenge or protest to that is that that's not true. And I think it takes something like an idea, because ideas, like, you want to be divided on them because we want to critically analyze them, and we want to that can be fun. So that's what ideas can do. Ideas can move people apart. And so one of the outcomes of this whole folk RPG gaming thing. An outcome of this hypothesis is that it brought people together. And that's been my observation. And that's something, again, like, you know, setting aside a product you can buy at Toys R Us or at a game store. And instead, it's something like fishing. Fishing inevitably will bring somebody together. Like, if you do a folk craft, like if you want to connect with people, that's why people go on dates to pottery things and stuff and do folk crafts as a date, because you want to connect with the person, you know. So that shared experience, it's almost inevitable that you're going to connect on that basic human level. That's been my observation.
Yeah, I've used an example several times when I've talked to people. I've kind of rejected the, and not when I say rejected, I don't mean like say none of it's valid, but I dislike the whole idea of there being a gaming community in terms of a community that can either include or exclude somebody. There's definitely a group of people that all enjoy the same hobby and have, you know, various thoughts, whether they agree or disagree on those thoughts. But I dislike the idea of there being a community in its sense of like there's a membership card that you have to have or that can be revoked. And I use the example of I'm a huge fan of riding motorcycles. I ride motorcycles. And much like you're just saying, if I encounter another rider at a coffee shop, you know, you'll have a conversation about, you know, what bike are you riding, and you'll have something in common that you can strike up a conversation about. But you know, at the same token, there's, you know, 1% gangs out there that I would have very little impersonal common with, outside of the fact that
the 1% motorcycles, the elite motorcyclists. I'm unaware of this. I didn't.
Okay, so sorry, a 1% motorcycle group would be like your Hell's Angels or your various.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They call themselves 1%ers.
Okay.
It's sorry. I suppose I should have clarified that, but yeah. So like, if you took like a hardcore motorcycle gang, I probably have very little in common with most of the people that are involved in it, other than we all enjoy riding around on two wheels, right? So like, that's why I kind of reject the whole idea of there being a community in the sense of there's a membership card, because if that was the case, then somebody might be like, well, you're a motorcycle fan, you should be rejecting. Well, no, I don't know, it just seems odd to me. And
nobody can tell you you can't fish. Yeah, every single human on the planet can find a thread and a stick and throw it in the water, and nobody can tell you you can't do it.
Yeah,
and that's the case with pencil, paper, and making up a five goblins being in a cave. There's no one that can tell you you're not allowed to do that.
Exactly. And so to try to even put out that form of control just seems silly, because it's not something that can be done. So instead of wasting effort and mind space on that, I'd rather find the things that, you know, everybody can chat about and have in common. Because like I said, I think in general, humans are way more in common than they're not. I think the problem online is that the focus is more trying to find all the things that are different rather than that are the same.
Who owns Star Wars, right? Disney owns Star Wars. Who owns space opera? Who owns mythology? No one, everyone. And that's the case. So I want to call out like two major influences of the videos. This one's huge for that was a few years ago, December 13th, 2022. Now we had already made this decision, I think, but this was like, I was like, man, this is it right here. Ben Milton from Questing Beast. I love that channel. D&D doesn't need WotC anymore, but the video does something way better, way deeper than that. It's that's when he's like, hey, this is like fishing. And that's when it clicked for me. I was like, yeah, that really crystallizes it. Like there are people that see D&D as a folk hobby. And what I had trouble with in 2021 is I was in a bubble, and internets, but also groups of people can do this as well. You end up kind of like in a bubble, and that affects your awareness of how things are and what people are doing and stuff. And I was very much in a 5e bubble. And in 5e, there is what I call an orthodoxy. Well, in the OSR, there's an orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. Like there's a prevailing, here's what you ought to do, here's what you shouldn't do. But in 5e, that was very much the case. And it wasn't supporting the kind of imagination, the kind of play that I wanted. And it was like, well, I bought the book, you know, from Walmart or Amazon. Here's what the book says. And there were people that like sort of treated it as scripture. And of course, as you said, this is an ancient problem. Like this is just something in the hobby for sure.
Yeah.
But eventually found more kitbashers. You know, certainly the OSR has more, they're replete with people that are willing to question things and be like, I don't know, maybe I want to do it this way. And anyways, that challenging that idea, that Questing Beast video was huge. And another one was Dungeon Craft. I love the title of this video. It's clickbaity, but it's funny. It's thank you. I will now destroy my own channel. And that was a key moment where for him, he was like, you know what? I'm done with the brand stuff. I want to focus on the kit bashers, the people that challenge orthodoxy, the people that are willing to be on the cutting edge. And when I was just about to shut down the play club, I was like, because I asked, I was like, hey, does anybody else want to do this? And people are like, nope, it's either you or it shuts down. And I was like, well, if it's going to be me, it's going to be this way. And I decided that I wanted to do that too. What Dan Masters, Professor Dungeon Master said, I was like, I want it to be a place where we focus on like all these little indie games and OSR stuff and things like that.
So with the group that you've got, and it's mostly an online group, or is it exclusively online at this point?
So it's both, but admittedly, in-person play has kind of fallen by the wayside. Sometimes we meet and play, but mostly online. Yeah.
what's your preferred tools? So if you were to give advice to somebody who's trying to start up a group like this, what tools, what's the minimum requirement? And what would you say has there been any tools that have been a game changer? So is there a minimum requirement to get in? And is there anything like, once you have that established, go for this set of tools to really help get things going?
Yeah. Let me skip ahead to the extreme example, because this is what I'll do sometimes in discussions. I have a friend, and for 4 years now, we've had amazing campaigns. We had a Dungeon Crawl Classics campaign using the 2E splat books from Planescape. And it was just so fun, so crazy. We've had a whole, he played in my Old School Essentials campaign. We had so much fun. Guy doesn't own a computer, has a cell phone, and that's it. And it's not an iPhone, okay? And he's ran his entire hobby online from that. Is it ideal? No. Do we have connection issues and, hey, I can't hear you again? Yeah, you know. But he's that passionate about it that he will get a hold of a Warhammer PDF for Wrath and Glory on his phone, and he'll read it, the PDF on his phone, and then try to run or play it on his phone. That's how passionate this guy is. I still want to get him a computer, but I'm just saying that's how you can play. If you can play, you know, if you don't have a phone or anything, then it gets a lot harder, and people have to be able to hear you. But I would orient it back to the social part, because that's the real thing. The real thing is, are you willing to check your guns at the door? And actually, and I think key to that, and this is something that I guess it just gets lost. I just don't know. But like the most core basic thing is, it has to be a relationship of consent. Like the starting point has to be, I am an adult that can make my own decisions, and I am consenting to this or not. And then we have a conversation, and you have to get back to basics. Like, hey, you want to hang out with my friends and go to the movies? And it's like that. And then you say, well, I don't know, I don't really like that movie. Hey, no problem. Let's do something else sometime. And it's so weird to have to say that out loud, but for real, that's just like what causes most of the problems, is a non-consensual basis. That's what I call the one invalid play style. And people talk about that, even saying it, people think, oh, that's about sexual or emotional stuff. No, no, it's about social stuff too. So for example, this is why I consider bringing a fully fleshed character to a game without talking to the group first, which I see happen all the time, non-consensual. And I call that like bringing a, I'm trying to think, but like,
bringing a big bag of nuts to a party when you don't know if anybody's
like bringing a, you know, like a 12 pack to an AA meeting or something, like, you know, like, hey, you're not wrong to have a 12 pack, but that's not what we do here. You know, like again, the key is that the authority, what is right, comes from the group. That's what right and true comes from. So you've got that 12 pack and you talk to the AA group and they say, hey, we're trying to lay off that 12 pack. And then you say, oh, that doesn't work for me. I'm here to drink Bud. Okay. You part ways amicably, and that's a good outcome. Yep. I don't know. That is the starting point. So when people are looking for a game, I would say to look for consenting adults that are willing to say, hey, here's what we do here. You want to be a part of that? And you can then say, no, or yes. That, I don't know if that sounds, that's
no, just, I mean, yeah, that's kind of in the never ending list of conversations that cycle through and come up and then fade away, they come up and fade away. You know, the safety tool discussion.
All of those problems are solved by that
one. Having a conversation.
Yep.
That's always been my thing too. Like I don't rail against, but I have a hard time understanding, I guess, the need for a lot of these tools. Cause for me, almost all those tools get negated by just having a conversation of setting, hey, this is what our game's about. This is the sort of stuff that happens in it. You want to play? Awesome. You don't? Well, okay. That's cool too.
Like on the flip side though, those things would work in a group where that arises out of that group as something that works for them.
Yeah.
So like, and I've seen that. I've observed groups where Either it's something I say works for them, but it might be like what I said is a working hypothesis. It might be that the group is working through that. And that's also something undervalued. Maybe this isn't the end product, but maybe it doesn't need to be shot down for the people that, you know, that's working for. And they can form that out, and that can develop without something outside of that group that doesn't understand it, saying, you know, well, you've got to quit that. Now, even in this format, some nuance is lost. We don't have time to try to go into all that.
Yeah, I was just thinking that too. Like, this is a whole other conversation completely to probably get down to what we truly think on it. But yeah, we definitely have to have another conversation on stuff like that. I think that would be cool. I know we're getting.
I'm just all about whatever. It's not just, hey, whatever works for you. But more so that people, I feel like what ends up producing the best result that I've seen is when you start with that consenting relationship with the group first, not seeking. You said some people come to Reddit and seek ideas. Man, that's I think that's not the place to start. Like,
talking amongst the group, saying, hey, guys, what's working, what's not, how can we fix it? Because I don't know. I've always viewed it like if you didn't start there, you don't know what problems you're actually solving. Like you're applying solutions to other people's problems that might not be
yours. You're undervaluing that human connection we were talking about. Like that's more important.
Okay. So we'll wrap up here in a few moments, but I definitely think we need to have another chat at some point. But a couple of final questions for you. You talked about playing a bunch of different games. Is there any games that are upcoming that you and your group are going to be playing that you kind of you're really excited about trying it for the first time? Is there any upcoming games that are like, oh, I can't wait for this to happen?
No.
No.
Oh yeah. So like I've been off work for 2 years because I've been disabled. And thank God I'm good to go. I've got a clean bill of health. I'm returning to work. I'm so thankful for that. But the games are coming. They're slimming down for me. I used to be experimenting and doing all kinds of games. This is what we're doing right now. We're doing this with Classic Traveler. Desert Moon of Karth by Joel Hines. And I'm just stitching together OSR stuff. And I'm also like, I don't know how you feel about this, but sci-fi feels really underserved in the OSR. It is. And it's like you said, like, hey, look, we got a lot of systems. But like, where's the adventure content and the stuff that makes it all work? And there's stuff like this that like you can just glance over this and run it at the table. And to me, that's just ingenious. But I don't feel like there's a lot in the sci-fi world. Mothership's doing some stuff. You've got White Star. You've got a few indie things. Let's do sci-fi.
The games are there. I actually had a conversation with somebody yesterday and brought this up with this similar topic came up. And I feel that the reason that you don't see horror or sci-fi or prehistoric dinosaur age role-playing games becoming as mainstream or as popular as fantasy is the shared mindset. Almost everybody has if you ask them to describe a castle, they'll doodle it down the same. If you ask them to describe a dwarf, they'll doodle it down somewhat similar. You ask somebody to draw an alien, you're going to get a wide range.
It's a challenge.
Yeah, it's that shared mindset that I think is the problem. Not that there's anything wrong with any of those games, and you can have amazing stories and have a great time. I just think that's why it hasn't reached mainstream, is because it doesn't have that same shared cultural backing that
fantasy
seems to have.
Let's challenge that, and let's break through and make awesome OSR stuff.
Yeah.
Let's do it anyway.
And you were saying space opera before. I think we're probably at a point now where, you know, people looked, I forget the name of the show, is that Amazon show that came out recently that was basically Star Wars with the
Rebel Moon.
It was Star Wars with the
Star Wars breakoff, right? The Millennium Schmalken. Let's do it.
If you can start having stuff like that, I think you can probably start seeing a shared mindset come from that sort of a thing as well. All right, I'm going to slip you into your GM seat for a minute. And we're going to say you've got a level one character. You said you like having a level one character. You got a party of level one characters, and you want to strike some fear into them by you rolled on a random encounter chart and a dragon's appearing.
Yeah.
How are you running that encounter for them? What is the experience they're going to have with the dragon? Are you going to be the cruel, unusual monster that's going to make them actually fight a dragon? Or are you going to, what's your plan?
I love it. I love it so much. So first of all, I'm not going to make them do anything.
There you go.
And I've had this. I had this on a Trilemma Adventures one page. So there's a dungeon where there's this thing falling off an ice cap. It has a white dragon inside, but they don't know until they get there. And it starts with the description of the dungeon that there's this icy vapor that pervades the antechamber when you enter the central area of it. And of course, they're there trying to find treasure. So they go off into a side room. Now, I know that you love BX, Old School Essentials. So they do something glorious. Actually, I'm not even going to say what I do. I'm going to say what happened, because that's what we do, right? Let's talk about what actually happened. And so they're looking for treasure, and they can see that it looks as if something happened to the skeletons. They were frozen so thoroughly and severely that one of the bones snapped off on its own accord. It seems to have happened a long time ago. So you're telegraphing, mm-hmm. and you can see that portions of the place are frozen, and they close the door behind them because they're smart. And they're searching the room, and they find the treasure. They find some stuff. They got to get out. And then they hear a voice on the other side of the door. Because I roll, you know, the encounter. I get a one. And that one procedure provides all of the apophenia for everything that's going on in the space, in my opinion. How far away it is, what its attitude is, and what it is, and if it's there. And so it's like 20 feet away. It's on, so it has to be on the other side of the door. I infer that. Because of how far away it is, and get a high reaction roll, which I think is the most underrated thing in the OSR.
Reaction to morale is something that does not get promoted enough.
It's the key is apophenia. So here it is. They have a high reaction roll. So this thing is a thing of pure malice and chaos, and it's there just to toy with people and to devour them. And it, you know, so is it going to be their friend? No, but it will toy with them, and so it starts to talk to them. Because it's highly intelligent, so it speaks common, and it starts speaking through the door. And so now they're like, okay, this door is closed. This thing is talking to us. What do we do? And one of them, a magic user with one hit point, level one, has the light spell. And so they're like, all right, guys, we got to get out of this room. We have to try. And I freely offer the information. I don't hide it. This thing is on the other side of the door. So if you figure something out, you do. And they're like, all right, we're going to open the door. I'm going to cast light. I don't go into combat procedure because I assume, you know, so, hey, look, but you could also do the procedure and it'd also be interesting. But anyways, they open the door and one person does, and the magic user casts light. The dragon fails its save. And I interpret that like, it's like a flashbang grenade. I love the light spell in Old School Essentials. So it's blinded for one round. You have a chance to get out of here. And that's for two of the five players, the first time they had ever played Dungeons and Dragons.
And they got both. They got a dungeon and a dragon.
They got a dungeon, a dragon, and the treasure, and they made it out alive. And this dragon hates them and begins plotting their destruction over a long period of time.
And now when that game session was all over and everybody stood up and they were talking about what just happened, how much of that discussion was like, holy crap,
Barely made it out of there. Oh my gosh. I can't believe, you know, and hey, look, here's the other thing. If they'd failed that save, they would have been icicles, and I don't care. And that's another key, because I believe I wrote this article that is admittedly a polemic, but I said, the myth of OSR lethality and the thing, and I want to call it a myth because lethality doesn't mean the characters are dying as an ultimate outcome. We had a Old School Essentials campaign for 14 months. No one died till month 13. And it's because if you can die, you can actually make choices.
Yeah, I think
you can't die, you can actually make choices. Yeah.
I think I'd almost rather than say high lethality, say high consequence.
Yes. Yes. That's great.
You either reap or sow whatever the consequences are of the actions. And it's highly based off of that rather than it be, because when you say high lethality, you think that it's always going to be the negative outcome as opposed to the other way around. When you got the message that, hey, you know, let's come and have a conversation. If you're anything like me, you run through things that might be talked about in your head. I always just have like that running dialogue of trying to predict how things will go. Was there anything that I should have asked you or that you were hoping I would have asked you that I didn't?
No, I just like talking about this stuff. That's like a, you know, it's not the game, but it's fun to do. Like, I'm so excited just to get to share the experience of somebody, that person who had never played D&D. Well, actually, yeah, and experiencing this like life or death, like getting out from the dragon, getting the treasure. That's thrilling. I'm instead of what should you've asked, I'm glad you asked that. That was fun. I love, I just like D&D.
So what should we chat about next time then?
I don't know. Maybe we should just talk about games and stuff that excites us instead of that. That seems to solve a lot of the, that seems to just be the direction to go in. I don't know.
I think everybody can find something in a conversation that's just about the stuff that you enjoy.
Yeah,
your own excitement for something is what brings everybody over. Yeah. Where can folks find like the actual plays and information about the group? Or if there's somebody going, that sounds exactly what I'm looking for, and they want to join your gaming group, how do they get in touch with you?
So that's an interesting question. I guess I don't have a permanent link for Discord. So on YouTube, it's at Mythic Mountains RPG is the channel. There's also, we have a podcast, that's Adventures in the Veil at Podbean, and we're on every major, podcast platform, you know, Spotify, Apple, etc. And if you leave a comment and you say, hey, I would like to learn more about this, or I love, as you can tell, like somebody who's never tried D&D or never tried an OSR game, I just love presenting that magic of, you know what, you're in a really crazy situation and you get to make any choice you want. And that's so fun, that I can't help but be like, let's figure out a way to get a game going. You know, like it's a pathological drive that I have.
Honestly, the favorite games I've ever had, like, and if I was like to think over all games I've played, easily in the top five, it's dominated by players or by games that feature players who have never played before.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Like those,
they're always not bound to their character sheet. They're willing to actually ask questions and something in the fiction.
And just seeing them realize for the first time that they can actually do whatever they want. Like that, yeah. when you see that kind of light turn on, you're like, oh, they're like, oh, they got it now.
Yeah.
And that makes it so much fun. I know we're tight on time. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on to the show and chatting with me. And I hope this kind of conversation can continue. I think you're right. This needs to happen more often with more folks, and just people can hear, you know, exchange of ideas without there being any sort of agenda to it. It just being a nice casual conversation about stuff that we all enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for chatting with me. I love it. Love talking about this stuff, and then really great to meet you.
Yeah. You as well. All right, folks, I'm going to pass this up to Future Me, who will do all the editing, and there'll be links in the show notes for all the links that were just mentioned. And thanks again, Ross, so much for coming on.
Wasn't that a pretty cool conversation? All right, folks, I'm going to wrap up this episode of the Red Caps podcast. I hope you enjoyed, that you learned something, and that you're eager to come back for more. www.theredcaps.net has all the links for all the ways to get in contact with me. And please do be like Ross's buddy and reach out and be like, I know a cool person to have a conversation with. You should reach out to them. Hook me up. Let's have more of these. This was a lot of fun. So thank you again very so much for listening. Remember, never let your caps dry out. Stay safe. Have fun. We'll talk again soon. Take care.